Well, again, welcome everybody, and I want to say thanks to our panelists for being here. We have a distinguished group of panelists who all know each other very well because they work closely together to move forward some of these new watershed initiatives that many of the conservation organizations in Texas are encouraging and promoting. And as Tom said, our topic here is healthy watersheds, and most of our panelists will spend a good deal of time talking about initiatives that they work on that focus on those linkages between land and water and stewardship of the land and the linkages that has to aquifer recharge, spring flow, water quality, healthy habitat for fish and wildlife, and lots of other benefits. So with that, I just want to go ahead and get started here. And so Gary Garrett is up first. He's a colleague from Parks and Wildlife Department and has spent the last couple of years leading the development of a new watershed conservation initiative, and a good deal of those efforts are focused here in the South Llano River watershed. So with that.
Okay, good evening. I wanted to talk about kind of the Parks and Wildlife's part of this really important movement throughout Texas, embodied in what we call the Texas Parks and Wildlife Watershed Policy and Management Program, or really the Watershed Conservation Program. And it's fairly new, as Tim mentioned, and what it is, it's recognizing the need for a more holistic approach to taking care of our natural resources. Texas Parks and Wildlife has been around for a long time and done a really good job of managing the natural resources of the state, but we found that there's really a lot better way to do this, a lot more efficient way to do this, and a lot more productive long-term way to approach taking care of our resources, and that is through a watershed approach. Our program really is not doing it by itself. We help to facilitate the entire department as well as other colleagues throughout the professions to come together and work in unison to work with landowners to take care of their watershed. So we try to develop these partnerships with landowners, and if we don't work with the private landowners of Texas, we're not working with very much of Texas at all. So that's really key to all of this. And this is just simply to conserve aquatic riparian upland habitat, something as simple as that. Really important stuff, really not very easy to do, but very important to all of our futures. So in doing this, we want to, promote an awareness and a desire for stewardship of habitats, organized communities to around their habitats and understanding the value of what's in it for them, establish local conservation partnerships and leverage available resources to get these things done. And one thing we can really do well is provide technical guidance and planning assistance to our citizens, to these groups. We're doing this throughout the state. We've got a lot of projects going on, but our best project, our largest scope project, and the one we plan to use as the format throughout the state because we think it's a really good approach, is taking place right here in the South Llano. What we're doing is we're using the state fish of Texas as really the status symbol of what's going on. The Guadalupe bass is the state fish of Texas. The enabling legislation that named it the state fish of Texas alluded to the fact that the Guadalupe bass is a living testament to the sparkling purity of our state's freshwater tributaries. And it truly is. When Guadalupe bass are doing well, it's usually a good indication that everything else is in pretty good shape. A lot of people can relate to the state fish, so it helps to get people's attention and gather around something that we all have in common. Excuse me. So we have kind of a multi-pronged approach to this in the Llano. One is to try to reduce the negative impacts of exotic or non-native species in the watershed. This ranges from things like a giant river cane, other plants, other animals. But we're really focusing on the Guadalupe bass there as well. Our state fish is threatened by hybridization with the non-native smallmouth bass. So to resolve that one in particular, we're stocking did this last year, 170,000 smallmouth bass, Guadalupe bass, and we're going to stock about 175,000 Guadalupe bass every year to dilute out and ultimately rid the river of these hybrids. There. And in addition, we're doing and helping to fund some assessments of the fish community and the aquatic habitats throughout the river to make sure of the shape it's in, what needs to be done, do everything we can to keep it in good shape. One of the other prongs of this approach is to recognize the really intact and healthy habitats that exist in the South and the North Fork of the Llano. This is really one of our better rivers in the state. And we want to make sure we don't forget about that part of it. We want to work with landowners to help them keep good things good. That's the cheapest thing we can do, and it's really the most long-term. So in doing that, we're working with the South Llano Watershed Alliance to develop a watershed conservation plan for the Upper Llano River watershed. In addition, we're encouraging support and stewardship of natural resources and providing guidance on best management practices. And there's a number of ways that we can do this, working one-on-one with landowners. Really an effective way is working with groups like the South Llano Watershed Alliance, which brings landowners together. In addition, paddling trails. It's a program we've got throughout the state. We're instituting one here in the South Llano in a few months, or next month, I guess. And it's a great way to get people out on the river, enjoying the resource, understanding the value of it, appreciating the value, and getting them to want to make sure that it's there in the future for their kids and their grandkids. We're also putting on watershed conservation workshops across the state to bring landowners together, show them a lot about how their watershed functions, the value of the way it functions, why it's a benefit to them, why it's a benefit to their neighbors, and why it's a benefit to the state and to the future. We've got a lot of partners involved in this approach. It's not just Parks and Wildlife. Like I said, it's groups like the Alliance, Texas Tech, Texas State, University of Texas, Fish and Wildlife Service, NRCS, Texas Forest Service, Nature Conservancy. There's a lot of us out there that are very interested in this. You hear some more about this from the other speakers tonight as well. We're all working together on this because it's very important. It's of a tall order. It's not easy to do, but it's so important. It's something we must do. The other part of this approach is to restore the degraded habitats. And there are in the South Llano. There are across the state. There's some here, too. To do this, we've already begun mapping and assessing some of the in-stream and riparian habitats in the river, documenting where the problems are and how we might go about resolving that, looking at the aquatic community and the habitat use as well, and then, as I say, laying out a strategy for restoration and how we'd approach that. I guess the most blatant and most obvious problem that needs restoration, there's a lot of erosional issues even here on the Llano. We've got steep cut banks, and really nobody likes to have their land falling into the river, having their fences fall into the river, losing their land. The river and the things that live in it don't like all that soil falling into the river either. It's really a no-win situation, and there are ways to resolve that. There's things that cause it. For better or worse, I guess it's good and bad. A lot of these issues are taking place on our state park, South Llano River State Park. And that's going to serve as a great demonstration area. We're going to be working closely with the park to immediately fix the issues there, but then to fix, if you look at those as symptoms, we're going to fix the symptoms. We're going to also look at fixing the causes of those symptoms. So not only will we make our state park a lot better place to go, last a lot longer with a lot less maintenance, but it'll also, like I say, be a really great demonstration area for all the rest of the folks to come see what it looks like and how this can be done. And finally, I guess one of our other workshops we just did this past fall, which was one we had not planned to do, it was a result of the Oasis Pipeline fire, the devastating fire that took place out here on the Llano watershed. Just as so many did across the state. We didn't see that one coming at all, but boy, you talk about a habitat issue. It's big-time habitat issue, and How do you fix that? What do you do? There's a lot of erosion resulted from that. A lot of landowners wanted to get out and fix their ugly burned land just as quickly as they could. And sure, we would all like to do that, and there's some good ways to fix it, and there's some bad ways that may result in short-term looking better, but long-term looking really ugly. So we convened some of the experts, really every expert we could find in the state, to discuss and figure out a plan of action. We did that, and then we turned around and put on a public workshop, fire ecology and restoration workshop, where we had a lot of demonstrations for the landowners to kind of show just how to avoid erosion, how to reduce erosion, how to regain your vegetation, how to keep from losing your topsoil, a number of very important issues like that. And I think it was well received, and as I said, we didn't see that coming. We had to move pretty fast, but I think that resulted in a very good workshop, and it's really exemplifies the sorts of things that we need to do to all work together and take care of our watershed. Thanks.
Gary and I spend a lot of time focused on conservation of fish and wildlife resources and really bring that perspective into watershed scale conservation. But nearly 40% of fish and mussel species in Texas are considered imperiled, and that trend is really consistent nationwide. And the primary cause of that is watershed alteration. And we've learned that a lot of the actions that we've been taking for years have really focused on, you know, placing Band-Aids over some of those symptoms instead of really focusing in on the causes of degradation. And so we believe that this is a better approach to focus at these larger scales where we can actually do something meaningful. And you know, these watershed approaches bring together lots of different resources, lots of different organizations, and allow them to identify shared interests and priorities, leverage resources, and again, focus attention at scales that are meaningful. So this is something that the State Soil and Water Conservation Board has been trying to do for a lot of years, and they've been doing it really well. And Aaron Wendt is here to talk about that, and Aaron is the statewide watershed planning coordinator for the Soil and Water Board.
Thanks, Tim. As he said, I'm with the Texas State Soil and Water Conservation Board, and whenever I have an opportunity to talk to landowners and citizens across the state, I feel a little obliged to spend a minute or two about our agency, because we're one of the smaller agencies in the state, and not many people may have heard of us by name, but I think a lot of people know the things that we do out in the state. Our agency has been around for 70-plus years working with landowners across this state, working with farmers and ranchers to put conservation on the ground. With our agency, from a state agency perspective, our partners at the federal level are, of course, USDA, Natural Resources Conservation Service, but we couldn't do what we seek to accomplish without local involvement. And so our local soil and water conservation districts that are across the state work with us and landowners to accomplish natural resource protection across the state. We're here to talk about healthy watersheds, but I want to maybe remind us of a little bit of history. Let's go back to the 1930s, to the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. And I know many of us have heard the stories of the dark clouds of dust that moved across the entire nation and eventually made it to D.C. and clouded out the noonday sun. And so when we talk about healthy watersheds, I think that that's something good to remember that our nation faced 70-plus years ago, that we've solved a lot of those issues, but other challenges continue to exist. My agency primarily serves or has five responsibilities, I think. One of them deals with water quality. In coordination with our sister agency, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, we have responsibilities to deal with agricultural and forestry-related non-point source pollution. TCEQ deals with most other forms of water pollution. My agency also, of course, as I said, works with the soil and water conservation districts and helps them put on their programs across the state. One of our third primary agency goals is water supply enhancement through targeted, selective control of encroaching brush. So what can we do to help increase the supplies of water for drinking water and agricultural irrigation and for industrial use? We also have responsibilities to deal with flood control. There's nearly 2,000 small flood control dams across this state that their primary purpose is to protect lives and property, but they also have secondary benefits to help protect the quality of water as well as help support by keeping sediment out of major water supply reservoirs. And finally, our agency is involved in invasive species. We help facilitate the Texas Invasive Species Coordinating Committee. So how do those agency responsibilities fit into what we want to talk about here, healthy watersheds and landowners and things that can be done on the ground? Well, from a water quality perspective, many state agencies and federal agencies involved in water quality, I think we tend to focus on the not healthy watersheds. Most of our state and federal agencies that have water quality responsibilities, many of our actions are driven by the Federal Clean Water Act 303D list of impaired waters. And in Texas, that list is substantial. We have, depending on how you count the numbers, we have maybe nearly 1,200 impairments across the state. So if you look at a water body and a specific pollutant, we have a large challenge across the state. Maybe half of those are dealing with bacteria, and bacteria affects recreation with our aquatic resources. And so if we have the challenge of restoring water quality in that many watersheds, then it is exactly like Gary said, the cheapest alternative is to prevent that. The cheapest alternative is to protect our healthy watersheds out there so that our list of impaired waters doesn't continue to grow. We've been talking about watersheds. So what exactly is a watershed approach? I think if we're going to talk about how to protect watersheds or even restore impaired watersheds, we need to look at them from a watershed approach. And of course, that applies a specific geographic focus that looks at hydrology as opposed to political jurisdictions. A lot of the planning efforts that go on in the state and federal levels really talk about jurisdictions of where the county lines are and city boundaries and what those agencies have to do for themselves. But if we're talking about watersheds, we really need to set aside political boundaries and talk about the natural watershed out there. Also, the watershed approach really looks at environmental objectives based on scientific data. And so if we're talking about, again, a good example was the erosion and the cut stream banks, we need to understand what's happening in our watersheds so that we can put the right solutions on the ground. The watershed approach also helps us to coordinate whatever solutions we decide to work on and put those on the ground. And I don't think that anything that we want to accomplish could be accomplished without partnerships, without local landowners, citizens, and homeowners working with their government, their local, state, and federal governments to help them solve issues that affect the homeowners and the landowners. So when we talk about a healthy watershed, what might we be talking about? What benefits are achieved from a healthy watershed? Again, the example was giant cane. There's other invasive species out there like salt cedar or giant salvinia or other a variety of species out there that don't belong in these watersheds. And so healthy watersheds help us decrease the vulnerability to those invasive species. I think that healthy watersheds also, of course, provide habitat. That was a big point of what Gary was saying, that Parks is emphasizing with the Guadalupe Bass Initiative and whatnot. But fish, aquatic species, as well as habitat for terrestrial species. I mentioned one of the responsibilities that our agency has deals with flood control. Healthy watersheds also help us protect against the impacts of floods. I know we're in a drought situation here in Texas, but we did have some storm events that just came through the state, and flood events do occur. And if a watershed is healthy, if it has the right biological communities, it can help ameliorate those impacts of floods. And finally, I think another benefit or value of healthy watersheds has to do with groundwater. The healthy watersheds help us help with aquifer recharge and also help with the quality and quantity of surface water. So if we're out there looking at a watershed and we've looked at these issues and tried to assess the health of that watershed and we think it's a healthy watershed, well, what do we do? How do we keep it that way? What do we do to protect that watershed? I think one way that we can do that is by writing down our goals and objectives for that watershed, planning for solutions and activities that we want to accomplish in that watershed to keep it healthy. And one way to do that is to write a watershed protection plan. And so what is watershed planning? I think, again, these are mechanisms to voluntarily address water issues across political jurisdictions. Watershed protection plans in Texas, a lot of the discussion and focus of watershed protection plans have been on those impaired waters. But I think, as I alluded to earlier, we need to do a better job of documenting those watersheds and water bodies that are healthy and doing the things that we can do to protect them. These watershed plans help us holistically look at the water resources in a watershed. And so if it's an impaired water body, a watershed protection plan is going to help us look at all the different sources that may be causing that impairment, that may be polluting that water body. I think the same thing can be said for a healthy watershed. We can look at all the different factors that may be stressing that watershed, all the different things that may be changing in that watershed that puts it at risk. And then, of course, these watershed protection plans, they're frameworks for action. And so we can talk about planning. We can talk about collecting data and analyzing data, but the real intent is that plans are frameworks for action by landowners and homeowners and by their supporting governmental agencies. I think the final point I make about watershed plans is that they're adaptive. Whatever we write down, whatever we say is occurring in our watershed today may not be what is happening in a few years. Whatever actions we say we want to take right now, we need to learn if they're working or if they're not. So watershed plans are adaptive and we can change them. Just because we wrote something down today doesn't mean we have to do that same thing several years from now if it's not working. We can change those plans and relook at what's occurring in a watershed. I guess the last overarching point I would make is how can landowners, how can homeowners become directly involved in protecting their water bodies or restoring impaired water bodies? I think that citizens across the state need to become engaged with agencies up at this table and non-governmental organizations as well. There are mechanisms that are occurring right now in a lot of watersheds across the state to protect them or to restore them. And it's not a long-term productive outcome if it's just governmental agencies. We can't accomplish what we need to accomplish without landowners and homeowners. So I really encourage them to be involved and communicate with their local governments, with their county governments, their cities, the soil and water conservation districts, so that state and federal agencies can understand what our priorities should be. What do the citizens want us to focus on? And then, of course, there's a whole list of actions that homeowners and landowners can take on their property. Farmers and ranchers can talk about nutrient management, and they can talk about good grazing management practices. Homeowners can begin talking about how they fertilize their yard or rainwater harvesting, and the list goes on. And so I think that citizens need to be engaged with agencies and NGOs and help take action and set the example. And as Gary said, stewardship is a key phrase to emphasize here. One of the last points that I like to make when I talk to audiences and the public is that the responsibility for decisions regarding water resources resides at the local level. And so without landowner and homeowner input and guidance and direction, we can't protect healthy watersheds. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. And our next panelist is Christy Muse. She's the executive director of the Hill Country Alliance, and she's involved in serving as a major advocate for preserving the unique character of the Texas Hill Country, including preserving natural resources, water quantity, water quality. And she's one of the sponsors, one of the organizers of this Texas Water Symposium series, and has been really a great partner for all of the agencies listed here and a major advocate for all the initiatives that you'll hear about tonight, and is right now leading one of her own new initiatives that I think she'll probably spend some time talking about, which is a new watershed conservation initiative in the Pedernales River watershed. So, Christy.
You know, life in the Hill Country depends on water. Good, clean, clear, abundant water. Those aren't my words. Those are Sky Louie's words. Some of you may know Sky Louie with the Nueces River Authority and as a leader in riparian land management throughout the region. Sky's also the president of the Hill Country Alliance and a great person to work for. I imagine most of us have memories of swimming in a Hill Country stream. That cool water flowing over limestone rocks on a hot summer day. There are those chutes and natural tubes in the river where we scoot down and ride through when the water's rushing. And then those large, flat limestone rocks we kind of tiptoe out to and sunbathe or dangle our feet in the water. Hidden grottos that somehow stay cool and lush with ferns, even in those dog days of summer. And you know, then those meandering, lazy rivers that reveal fresh scenery at every turn in the bend. For those of us, like myself, who moved here as an adult, this was a magical discovery to be in the Hill Country with these waters later in life. For my lucky kids, however, who are being raised here in the Hill Country, it's just the norm. It's something that they've grown up expecting. It's something that perhaps they take for granted. We live near Bee Creek, which is part of the Lake Travis watershed, and we are lucky enough to have access to the creek, and my kids love to explore the creek in all seasons. I'm going to tell you a little story. A few years ago, one of the large ranches in the upper reaches of the Bee Creek watershed that encompasses about 2,000 acres was sold and platted for development. And I'm not talking about just a few homes. I'm talking about a major development with as many homes as you could possibly put on those 2,000 acres. An initial plan looked at about 4,000 rooftops. These are over steep hills with minimal topsoil. The project began by clearing large areas of land for the roadway that would go through the development. And in typical Hill Country fashion, an uninspected rain event sent layers of water, debris, silt down the creek and into Lake Travis. There were construction controls in place, but the construction controls had failed. And for that, swimming in the creek was over for a while, and for the next season, the creek was full of silt and full of algae. At the same time, not far away, there was a similar event in Lick Creek where a detention pond failed, and a once pristine Lick Creek became a muddied hole. And you may have read about a much more widely publicized event that occurred in Hamilton Pool. A similar situation, large hilltop was cleared for development, the uninspected rains came, a mess in Hamilton Pool, and to the tune of a $3 million cleanup. This story, unfortunately, is being repeated all over the Hill Country as development pressure pushes out of our cities into the unincorporated areas. And in unincorporated areas that have minimal control over development. And unfortunately, once a water quality problem like this occurs, it's very difficult to clean it up. In some cases, the damage is irreversible. The Regional Water Quality Protection Plan happened in 2005. And I think it's interesting to be reminded that the plan discovered scientifically that as little as 6% impervious cover in any given sub-watershed can severely alter the quality of the water quality in this fragile hill country topography. Yet still, very few tools exist to deal with this impervious cover in our rural and unincorporated areas. So as issues like these hit close to home, people tend to get involved, they get engaged, and they get motivated to seek solutions. And frankly, it's one of the reasons why the Hill Country Alliance was created in 2005. Today, we are educating and advocating for a more proactive approach to dealing with these challenges, not only our water resource challenges, which is what we're all gathered here today to talk about, but also the protection of our scenic beauty, the wildlife habitat, our cultural assets, heritage ranch lands, night skies, and that unique character found only here in the Hill Country. The HCA works in 17 counties, covering over 11 million acres. I think when people, if you can imagine from Austin to Burnett County, Llano County, out Mason, Kimball, Edwards, Medina, Uvalde to San Antonio and up the I-35 corridor. That's basically where we work in the Texas Hill Country. I think when you think about a map of the Hill Country, what you typically see is county lines, roads, rivers, and cities. But very rarely do we visually see watersheds. For water planning professionals like Aaron and my co-panelists here who think in terms of watersheds, they understand the purpose of a watershed protection program is to provide a clean, plentiful water supply. But in general, people are not making this connection. People rarely think about the health of a watershed, especially those people that are living in the more urbanized areas where their experience and their observations have taught them that watersheds are features that fill up quickly when it rains and carry away the city's pollutive runoff. For many who live in and near the cities, the thought of swimming in a natural creek, it's just never even crossed their minds. What we would like to do is create a constituency of people who understand what a watershed is, who know what watershed they live in and what is occurring in their watershed, and how to take care of their watershed for future generations. The TCEQ, our environmental agency, frankly, is just not equipped to monitor water quality in every part of the state and all activities that impact our water quality. It is going to take an educated and motivated citizenry to call attention to degradation when it occurs, but also to be watching out for signals when problems could be on the horizon. So, one simple way we propose to think about watersheds a little more differently is to begin to use some new language. The term watershed, it implies drainage or shedding away our water. And we have a limited water supply and it is in great demand. Why on earth would we shed away our water? There is no question that our water supply is dwindling. In many parts of the Hill Country, groundwater supply is being used faster than it's being recharged. In other words, we are mining our aquifers. We're taking more than nature provides. Many river basins are also overallocated. And to quote a Texas Water Development Board member regarding the recent plan, the primary message of the 2012 state plan is a simple one. In serious drought conditions, Texas does not and will not have enough water to meet the needs of its people. We've got to pay attention to that. There are over 500 strategies identified in the state water plan. The common theme is finding new water. So we can't afford to shed away our water supplies. Let's consider reframing the language from watersheds to water catchment areas. And let's place value on our water catchment areas as places to naturally capture, store, and cleanse our water. It's not a new idea in other parts of the globe. This is the language that exists and is commonly being used. I think this new way of thinking will help us see that land conservation and land stewardship practices within these water catchment areas can provide a practical, low-cost, natural catchment and filtration system that will sustain water supplies for future generations. Currently, land conservation is not a strategy in the state water plan, and that's something that needs to change. Even if we could afford the dams and engineering solutions that are commonly referred to in the plan, it wouldn't solve our water supply problems unless we first protect the land in our water catchment areas or watersheds. So HCA has some wonderful resources available online so that people can find out what watershed they're in. You can take a quick tour of your watershed and learn your major and your minor watershed by going to hillcountryalliance.org. And we could encourage people to access that resource and also sign up to receive our information and start getting our newsletter so you can find out what's happening in your watershed. We've also begun collecting an inventory of watershed protection plans, these processes that Aaron referred to that are going on here in the Hill Country, in order to give citizens the tools they need to get more engaged. So let's briefly take a little tour. I'm just going to touch on some of the processes that are going on so that maybe I'll tweak some interest from some of those that are listening. In and around our two cities, San Antonio and Austin, there are many watershed planning activities in place. And like Aaron stated, these are mostly reactive, in place to deal with already impaired water supplies. Citizens can get involved. You can contact your city and contact the Watershed Protection Department and get involved also with your river authority, the Lower Colorado River Authority in and around Austin and the San Antonio River Authority in and around San Antonio. SARA, the San Antonio River Authority, also has just recently initiated a holistic plan for the Medina River. So anyone listening that's in the Medina River Basin, please pay attention. They're in the initial phases of the plan right now, gathering the data and the science, and they're going to be requesting citizen input shortly. If you're tuned in, you'll be able to get involved and participate. Cibolo Creek up in Kendall County has a great plan going on, and the city of Bernie is the leader in that. Further west, the Nueces River has plans going on in the upper Nueces, the Frio, the San Miguel. And the Guadalupe River Authority has plans in the upper Guadalupe, Plum Creek, Alligator Creek, Geronimo Creek watersheds. In fact, a news release was initiated today stating that public input is being requested on initial plans for Geronimo Creek and Alligator Creek in the Guadalupe River Basin. You've heard a lot about the LANO project, which is a fantastic project here in the Kimball County area. But I'd also like to bring your attention to the Cypress Creek project. The Cypress Creek project is being coordinated by the River Systems Institute at Texas State University, the Wimberley Valley Watershed Alliance, and GBRA. Cypress Creek is part of the Blanco Watershed, and it's located near Wimberley. Like the LANO, the Cypress is also currently a fairly healthy watershed. So the intention of the plan is to maintain integrity in this developing area. Phase one, the science and data collection is complete, and now they are rolling out phase two with some very specific strategies. But it's because of the Cypress Creek Project that community leaders in the municipalities along the watershed are much more intimately informed about the resource and the consequences that exist if we don't plan. It's interesting because recent groundwater planning activities have brought a lot of attention to Jacob's Well. There's a concern that groundwater management goals are threatening the springs and the life of the creek and the Blanco River. So the city, just a few weeks ago, passed a resolution calling for a special management zone to protect these springs. And in my opinion, this action wouldn't have taken place had these community leaders not already been engaged and involved in the Cypress Creek Watershed Protection Plan. That's how they learned. That's how they got there. HCA has been doing some work bringing stakeholders together along the Paternalis, as Tim mentioned, and we hope to be rolling out something there soon. Maybe not HCA, but we hope to bring enough people together to light some fire and get something happening. Working with Parks and Wildlife, we're going to be hosting some landowner workshops May 12th and May 5th up and down the Paternalis watershed. Lots of landowners are coming together. There's a lot of interest there, and it's exciting. I started with a quote from one of my board members, Sky Louie, and I'm going to end with a quote from a board member, Milan Michalek, who is also with the Cow Creek Groundwater Conservation District. Milan says, "All previous settlers of this region learned how the land and its resources, particularly water, could only support so many people, a certain quantity of livestock, or a particular industry before its quantity and quality would be impaired. So for all who choose the Hill Country as their home, an opportunity exists to accommodate existing needs without compromising the ability of future populations to meet their needs." This do-no-harm mentality is what we hope to inspire at HCA, and we invite all of you to get become involved in our conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Christy. And I'm a fish head, so I have to throw out a few numbers, but there are 15 species of endemic fishes in the Texas Hill Country, and those are fishes that are found nowhere else in the world. And, you know, that's just one aspect of the uniqueness of the Texas Hill Country, and it's great to have people like Christy who have that energy and want to really get out there and educate and inform and promote stewardship of the resource. And the numbers that I continue to hear are that human populations in the Hill Country are expected to increase 20% over the next 10 years, and portions of the Hill Country are expected to double in population size over that time frame. And so, you know, very important that we get out there and educate and inform, and all these new folks that are moving in, that they understand this character that we want to try to preserve. So our next speaker is Dr. Kevin Wagner. He's the Associate Director of the Texas Water Resources Institute, and there he leads science and extension programs that really help provide those best management practices, that information that's gonna lead to effective practices on the land. So, Dr. Wagner. Thanks.
Thank you, Tim. Well, it's a pleasure to be here this evening. As Tim said, I work for the Texas Water Resources Institute. We're located at Texas A&M University and are part of AgriLife Research and the AgriLife Extension Service. But we were set up under the Water Resources Research Act, the federal act, and it just so happened we landed at Texas A&M. But our mission is to not only serve Texas A&M, but to serve the entire state in conducting and facilitating high priority water research, education, and outreach activities. Obviously, watershed assessment, training, education, and research is one of our primary focus areas, and has been since probably 2005 is when a lot of our efforts have really got kicked off there. We're currently working in about a dozen watersheds across the state, everywhere from the Pecos watershed west of here to some watersheds near the Beaumont area in the southeast Texas, to the Arroyo Colorado watershed in deep south Texas, to Buck Creek watershed that's up in the panhandle. So basically work in all corners of the state. Unfortunately, on all those watersheds, we're dealing with the many impairments that Aaron Wendt spoke about. It's been a tremendous issue dealing with bacteria and other impairments around the state. And so I'm really super excited to be working here in the Llano River watershed where we're not impaired. You know, you've got a relatively pristine watershed here. And so I'm super excited to work with you here. But as some of the previous speakers said, you know, the area is not without issues. You've got the erosion issues that have been spoken about. You've got issues with the invasive species and the exotics. But beyond that, like some of our other speakers said, you know, we've got a growing population. We've got fragmentation of a lot of our large ranches, and it's being broken up into smaller ranchettes. That presents a lot of issues in itself. You have changing land ownership as older generations turn it over to younger generations, as more of the land is being owned by people that are living in the cities rather than people that are out living on the land. All of those bring a lot of challenges. You've also got increasing demands on the water. As these cities grow, they continually look to the hill country and surrounding areas for water. And then not only that, then you've got growing demands for the natural resources, for the hunting and the recreation and other activities. So all of these, compounded by the proliferation of the noxious brush species that's really grown up probably since the 50s throughout really most of Texas, and then like the invasive species, as we've already stated, on all that together presents some pretty serious challenges. And I'd really like to applaud the efforts of the South Llano Watershed Alliance and other groups that have already begun identifying some of those issues and taking things in their own hands to begin making the changes that are needed to preserve this area for future generations. Some of the key things that I think both Gary and Aaron pointed out was, how important it is for this local leadership. I mean, that is key to success of any watershed or any restoration efforts. I've seen many plans developed over the years, and if you don't have the buy-in or the participation of those local landowners, they end up being a report that's put up on a shelf and they never achieve anything. But I feel real confident with the efforts that are here, with the landowner buy-in and participation and their willingness to do what it takes, that won't be the case here in the South Llano watershed. So I'm really looking forward to, with the funding that's been provided by the Soil and Water Conservation Board and EPA to us, I'm looking forward to working with the field station here, the South Llano Watershed Alliance, and others here in the room, I'm sure, to take a holistic look at the Llano watershed, not only the South Llano, but also look at the North Llano watershed, and develop some strategies that the local people can buy into and get behind, that we can put into place to preserve this fabulous resource for future generations. What Tom Arsufi and the field station here and I hope to bring to the table is, number one, the good science, because, you got to have good science to base the actions on, to provide the education. We've already talked about a lot of different new landowners that may not be familiar with good land management practices. I think that's going to be a really critical part of our efforts, is to begin educating the next generation of landowners and some of these new landowners, and then working to get just the buy-in to get the to get success here. So I'm gonna wrap up real quickly, but I encourage you, all those of you that live within the watershed, to certainly stay involved. Encourage your friends and neighbors to be involved in this effort as we work together over the next 2 to 3 years to develop a watershed plan for the Upper Llano watershed. Go to the website, www.southlano.org. You can sign up there to receive information via email. And in the end, what we hope our work here will result in resources being provided to this watershed to begin implementing this plan. Resources like grant funding from the Soil and Water Conservation Board, TCEQ, EPA, and a variety of other areas for implementing the different strategies, possibly getting some funding from the Water Enhancement Program for doing some brush control, getting additional cost share funding from the NRCS and other agencies for doing some land management practices, getting assistance from Parks and Wildlife Department for doing some of that habitat restoration. So, you know, we're hoping we can pull all that together and get some additional resources put into this watershed. And I guess finally, I would encourage others throughout the Hill Country to really use the example of the Watershed Alliance here and begin forming those in other basins throughout the Hill Country. With that, I'll turn it over to Tim.
Thanks, Kevin. And that's what's really excited about this, the efforts of the South Llano Watershed Alliance and these other partners that have come together around the Llano, is that we've brought together all these disparate interests, folks that were solely focused on water quality issues, folks that were focused on fish and wildlife habitat, people that were interested in paddling or wildlife viewing or fishing, and getting all those people to come together, identify those shared interests, share resources, and move this plan forward. That's really exciting, and we're excited to be a part of it. Our next speaker is Dr. Tom Arsufi. He's the director of the Llano River Field Station. He's our host tonight, and he's also serving as the currently as the watershed coordinator for the Upper Llano River Watershed Protection Plan that you've heard about from several speakers. And he's a really well-respected aquatic ecologist, research ecologist. So, Dr. Sufi, thanks.
Thanks, Tim. The previous speakers did such a good job that they covered a lot of the territory, so I'm going to truncate my discussion tonight on just a few elements. You've all heard of Barry Commoner. Barry Commoner cited that there are four laws to ecology. I'm going to tell you one of them, and it's really not very good English, but it's one of the laws of ecology is you can't do just one thing. You can't do just one thing. And pretty much what that means is everything is connected. And when we start looking at watersheds or catchment basins and so forth, they're fairly complex systems. And they're going to take a very, you know, a multiple tactical solutions in order to solve some of the issues associated with those particular issues. I think watershed is a critical issue that everybody needs to pay attention to and care about. And why should they care about it? Here's a quote. All the water that will ever be is right now. We're not creating any more water on this planet. Here's a famous one you've heard before. When the well is dry, we know the worth of water. The watershed is the scale where we can do the best job of conserving and protecting our very, very precious resource. I want you to close your eyes and imagine the state of Texas. The outline of what the state of Texas is like kind of resembles a heart, doesn't it? Well, I want you to think about Texas as a heart. And you can supersede on that map of the heart, which is Texas, the Hill Country. The Hill Country is smack dab in the middle of Texas. It's that 17-county or so region that Christy was talking about. And if you put on that map of the Hill Country the concentration of springs, you know, that groundwater to surface water interaction of water, you would find the highest concentration of springs in the state of Texas is right in the middle of the heart of Texas. It's the pulse of Texas, right here in the Hill Country. Here's a quote. One of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. Now, go back to that image of the state of Texas and the hill country and all of those hundreds of thousands of springs that occur right in the middle of the hill country, and know that over the last 100 years, almost 25 of those springs have dried up. They no longer flow from the groundwater to the surface. That's water that is deprived to the watershed. That's water that's deprived to the wildlife. That's water that's deprived to humans. Here's that quote again. One of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. Every one of those springs that has dried up for whatever reason, brush, invasive species, overdrafting of the aquifer, is a wound on the earth, and it affects us, the species Homo sapiens. Now, here's another reason that I think you need to pay attention to watersheds. And there's some concerns about terminology and those kinds of things. And that's something to be thinking about. But if you look at the research underlying what the public understands about watersheds, there's only about 30% of us knows what the term even means. So how are we going to protect a watershed? How are we going to protect all these natural resources if we don't know what a watershed is? So I think scientific literacy is really an important component, and that is one of the things that we're going to be really emphasizing with the Llano River Watershed Protection Plan, is we're going to do all those scientific things you heard the speakers talk about in terms of brush, invasive species, water quality determinations, mappings, and those kinds of things, and management, best management practice. And we're going to get that information, and we're going to get it to the public, we're going to get it to the landowners, we're going to get it to the users. We're going to help develop with Texas Parks and Wildlife a watershed curriculum for our kids so that those kids can start learning about what a watershed is and appreciate a watershed at a very early age. Because remember, you know, some of the people that are not here in the live audience actually live in an urban environment. And oftentimes that urban environment is it's downstream. So they need the water, those springs that are producing the water that are flowing in these headwater river systems that are flowing down into Austin or San Antonio and so forth. They need to be aware of what we're doing upstream in terms of protecting the water resources on which they depend. Thank you.
Well, I wouldn't be a good Parks and Wildlife employee if I didn't use our motto and talk about how life's better outside. And you know, if I had a PowerPoint projector, I'd probably throw up a couple of pictures of my 6 and 4 year old boys and my 2 year old chocolate Labrador retriever playing in Slaughter Creek or Onion Creek since we've had the rains there over the last couple of weeks. But as Tom mentioned, you know, we need to promote literacy, environmental literacy. We need to promote education and an understanding of watersheds and all these connections that we've been talking about tonight. And you can bet that my kids know what a watershed is. And it's not because I preach to them. That's probably a lie. But I don't think it's because I preach to them. I think it's because I get them out there in the creek and they enjoy it and they want to understand, you know, where's this water coming from and what lives here, and they learn to appreciate it and. You know, I expect that they're going to vote to preserve those resources in the future and that they're going to be advocates for the things that we've talked about tonight. And again, I want to thank everybody for being here. I want to thank our panelists. This is a really interesting topic. It's a new topic for Texas that you see more and more groups getting behind and more partners coming together, not just because of the need, but the state of our economy, our budgets. There's very little we can do right now with the kinds of budgets that folks are working with. And so opportunities to come together, leverage resources, look for shared priorities, and move forward, that's that's where it's at, and that's what we're trying to do here. So we hope that you guys will get involved and be engaged in Texas Watershed Stewards, all these other different programs that were talked about tonight. So please visit these websites or visit us after this the symposium, and we'll point you in the right direction. So thanks a lot. And with that, if anybody has any questions, you can raise your hand. We've got a microphone here. We want to make sure that it gets recorded, because the question and answer session will be on the public radio website. And so if you have questions, I'll bring the mic to you, or I can try to repeat your question.
Hi, Mike. I just wanted to ask, what are the major sources of the bacteria you were talking about through the watersheds?
I think that when the watersheds that we're working in, through the data that's looked at, through the water quality monitoring and the water quality modeling that's been done, bacteria comes from a whole host and variety of sources. It comes from failing, malfunctioning septic systems. It comes from natural wildlife populations. It comes from livestock, from cattle and goats and sheep. It comes from wastewater treatment plants that are permitted to discharge bacteria. It comes from invasive species like feral hogs. Very rarely do we find a watershed where we can point to one single source of bacteria that is the thing that we have to control. Our bacteria issue across the state, we have to address a whole host of sources.
Yeah, if you had to summarize, what would you say are the biggest obstacles to effective watershed planning?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is that I've seen is really just getting awareness throughout the general public of, number one, just the water body and the that there's even a creek or a stream system there in many of the cases. And once you have that awareness, then what the issues are and what they can each person can do individually to help improve that situation. But generally, it's an awareness issue is one of the biggest problems that we come across. And when you move into an urban environment where you have so many people that you need to reach, that's when it becomes a huge challenge.
Do you have any groups that actively oppose this kind of plan?
What was the question again? Groups that actively oppose? Not that I'm aware of. I hope there's not. I just want to expand a little bit on what Kevin said. He's absolutely right. I think awareness is the biggest challenge. And awareness of, as humans, we all, whether we admit it or not, kind of always have this what's in it for me kind of approach to questions. And a lot of people don't really understand what's in it for them. What's the benefit of a healthy watershed, particularly in the urban environment? They don't understand how beneficial it is to them. And that's why it's really important for all of us to work together to get that message out, to do things like get people out onto the countryside, into the rivers, on the uplands. Get out there and play. Get out there and enjoy it. Take your kids out there. Once you start to see it that way, then it becomes very, very important, and you want to make sure it's always there for future generations.
I'm sure all of you have been to the Rim Shopping Center and seen the big retention ponds that catch the water that run off from the parking lot. And the reason they're there is because whenever land is paved, the water runs off faster and runs downhill to the downstream property and floods. So it's a flood control issue. What I'm wondering is if that same technology could be applied to hill country creeks, where we would build retention dams and have retention ponds on the creek. And of course, there'd be a pipe in the bottom of the dam, and the pond would slowly drain and go downhill as it was intended to do, so they wouldn't interrupt any downstream users. Is there an advantage from a conservation standpoint for replenishment of the aquifer by such a plan?
Short answer is no. It's really streams, rivers are designed to function in a healthy way. They are designed to flush. They need to flush. They need to flood a bit. When we have the really devastating floods, it's typically because not the stream being built wrong and functioning wrong. It's things we've done as humans to the landscape. This impermeable surfaces that shed water too fast. Unhealthy riparian areas that let the water come screaming through there and tear things up. Really, when you build retention dams, you tend to stop that natural function that goes on. Streams need to move sediments downstream. That's part of being healthy. You build a dam, it starves the streams, the downstream portion of sediments. You really basically upset a natural process. Not saying it can never be done in a right way, but it's really, really tough to do. Often that's a big part of it, yeah.
Is it possible, or when is the erosion project or the watershed project in the park, the state park, going to start? I'd like to be able to see the before and after, because we've got a small park in our subdivision in Bandera that we've got a big erosion problem with the Medina River. And it'd be interesting to see what we could do in our subdivision.
Yeah, sure. So, right now we're working on a master plan for about a 5-mile segment of the South Llano River, and really expect to have that completed this fall. And we would be moving forward with some of the bank erosion and bank stabilization projects, probably fall of 2012, over the course of the next several years, and. The beginning, the first steps would be to move forward with some of that work at the state park, and we really hope to use that as I think Gary referenced earlier, as a conservation demonstration area for some of these practices that can be done. And then we're also working with private landowners up and down the river, and there are a number of these types of projects that we could follow up after this discussion, and I can point you toward some projects that are being done in San Antonio and a number of other places where they're trying to stabilize erosional banks.
I just want to try and make sure I got it right, and I did have a couple questions. Did I hear, was that from Christy Muse, that it was like 6% impervious cover causes an impact? Did you say 6? 6%. Okay. And did I hear, I'm pretty sure, Gary, that you were talking about, like, the Llano River is pretty good? Like, the Llano River is pretty good and, help keep good things good? Okay. And now I think that one of the biggest universities in the state is A&M, and another big one is Texas Tech. Is that right? So, and y'all are partners on this? And that one of the initiatives is to really get this information out to the public of the science. And so is there a part of your program that is going to come up with the answer of how many people will fit here to not exceed the 6% impervious cover to keep the good things good? Yes.
We'll work on that.
I hope you can accomplish.
And there's an enormous amount of research that's going on in different watersheds, and one big one is the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And they have about 20 years worth of monitoring data now, and they're looking at impacts from impervious cover within tributaries of the Chesapeake Bay watershed on blue crab populations and all these important fisheries that they have there in the bay. And so those numbers that, that Christy alluded to for the Hill Country, those are the standard numbers that you hear really in any watershed where these types of studies have been done. And it's usually when you get between 5 and 10%, you really see that tipping point where you see major negative impacts to fish and wildlife especially, but also bacterial loading, water quality, a number of other issues. And so a lot of the striped bass population issues that, that you heard, you may have heard about in Chesapeake Bay, of course the blue crab population was decimated there, and they were able to link that through their monitoring programs to development that occurred in the Washington, D.C. area and a lot of these other areas in West Virginia. And so what's being done in Maryland, West Virginia, and other areas of the Chesapeake Bay watershed is these programs are really trying to get involved in land use planning and zoning to try to protect those watersheds. And that's a lot of what these guys here that are sitting at the table are trying to do. So it's sort of a new initiative here in the state. We were a rural state for many years, and we haven't been since about 1985. I think that's the year that the number of people in the state surpassed the number of cattle in the state, but we still see ourselves as rural, and it's time to look at ourselves as an urban state and begin to address these land use planning and zoning issues. But good comment. Well, we're working on it. I mean, this, yeah.
Is there a way to get citizens involved in the science? Because I think that's when people buy into things, when they're involved and they see it themselves, what's really happening. I don't think people can really see what's happening unless they actually have hands on.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. For a lot of people, I mean, we know there's enough research about people's different learning styles. And for some people, the hands-on active engagement is really critical. So one of the big movements now nationally, and one of the things that educators and scientists are starting to recognize, and there's a lot of emphasis on what's called citizen science, where groups get together, and I'll give you an example. The Lady Bird Wildflower Center, one of their focus issues is invasive species, and they actually have citizen science groups going out and doing studies on invasive species. Another example that I think you're familiar with is the monarch butterfly monitoring or the Christmas bird counts. Those are the types of things where the public can get involved. It's an element of a watershed, a wildlife or population, and it buys them interest into the natural resources. So I think citizen science is a really critical issue, and it helps improve scientific literacy.
I think two other good examples are the Texas Master Naturalist Program, which is a program run by A&M Extension, as well as Parks and Wildlife, and that helps get citizens out into the natural environment and trains them on the science so that they can then talk to other citizens about the science. And then another good example, another program that citizens can be involved in is the Texas Stream Team, which is a volunteer water quality monitoring program that the state has. It's managed by Texas State University in San Marcos. And so those are two good examples of how citizens can be directly involved.
Well, also, you can be directly involved in the watershed protection plan itself by serving as a stakeholder. And then during the different rounds of accomplishments in the watershed protection plan, they quite often put that out for citizen input, citizen comment. And so there's lots of opportunities for citizens to weigh in all along the way. I just wanted to address two comments about what's kind of standing in the way from the watershed planning process, and then the other comment that was trying to make some connections about the impervious cover. And I think it's important to remember that these watershed protection plans are not necessarily it's a little bit different than a regulation being put into place. And I think maybe my colleagues here that are in governmental organizations might not be as free to touch on this as I am with an NGO, but that whole regulatory piece is the next step. You know, and until citizens are really engaged and informed about what needs to happen, involved in the watershed protection plan, when the recommendations are made, if the regulations that currently exist aren't going to accommodate what's recommended in the plan, then it's time to seek tougher regulations, tougher enforcement. All of that's got to come later. But that, in my opinion, is one of the greatest obstacles, is just the lack of the regulatory power, will, and enforcement.
I guess one of the questions I'd like to ask the panel is, as you do your planning for water in the Hill Country, how does your agency deal with the increasing variability in climate that we're seeing? I mean, obviously, all the plans were based on what we have known, but if we continue to move into a climate that was like 2011, and the state climatologist has said we may be under the gun for the next 20 years, how do you incorporate that sort of variability into your plans, and or do you?
That's a great question. It's a tough one we're all wrestling with. But one thing we can do, and it fits right into what we're doing anyway, and that is we talk about a healthy watershed, a healthy environment, a healthy ecology going on in a watershed. That's also a very resilient environment. So the healthier it is, the more resilient it is, and the more it's able to withstand this variation that we're likely to start seeing, these extremes. How resilient it's going to be, I mean, who knows? It depends on how crazy things get. But I think that's really the best we can do. And that's pretty good to do that. It's tough to do that, but I think that's good enough. It's a worthy enough goal right there, I should say.
I think another consideration when we start looking at things like climate, where we have some deterministic idea of what's going to happen, these plans are we've called them living documents. They're flexible, they're adaptive, so that they can change in response to changing information and knowledge. And one thing I really want to say about these watershed plans, conservation plans, or protection plans, or whatever, here's another reason why they're really critical and they're really important. And I think everybody that lives in a watershed, if somebody is not helping develop a watershed plan, they need to be doing it. Because one of the terms that I wanted to get across is the term proactive. And sort of the antonym to proactive is reactive. And historically, the way we deal with environmental problems is reactively. And so that's why we have like the 319 funding, is we wait until a water system, a lake, a river, a stream gets so polluted that nobody wants to swim in it, nobody can drink it, no fish can live in it except the scummy fish. And it's covered with algae and it's really bad. Then we say, okay, we need to fix this. Well, that's really, 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 really expensive. And the proactive approach is to say, hey, we've got a watershed, and it's in fairly good shape now. There may be a couple of issues and problems with it, but if we proactively manage it now, it'll be there in the future, and it won't go bad, and it's going to do all the things that a healthy watershed do that benefit not only natural resources, but benefit us.